You are listening to the award-winning, life-saving, automated episode of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast.
Episode 104 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is September the 22nd, 2013. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my Emmy-nominated brother, James Furlough.
Which one is the Emmys again?
That's the one that celebrates a dying media type, TV.
TV! Television. Yeah. So speaking of that, we finished House of Cards.
That's perfect timing. You should watch the opening part of the Emmys.
Really?
It's pretty good. Okay, it's worth watching, you know, the first like 10 minutes or whatever it is. I think.
Okay, I will do that. And as such, we have just started the original Star Trek series.
Nice. I started I'm picking back up Breaking Bad, which
I heard that's pretty good.
I hear, yeah.
Or bad, you know.
Well, I don't know. The show stresses me out unlike any TV show I've ever watched. And it's not one of those ones where it's like it stresses me out because, man, I just looked at my room. It's totally messy. But it's not one of those
different
shows
than all the other podcast shows, so it's okay.
It's the start of the thing, yeah. it's one of those things where the show stresses me out because it's like there are TV shows that stress me out because it's like awkward situations make you feel awkward. But I get the feeling with like I'm trying to come off as the sanest way possible while saying what I'm feeling. I feel like that show could happen to me.
Oh.
Which really stresses me out, where it's just like sort of a, I've got a really good idea in that it's a really terrible idea, but you're just kind of like seeing where it goes and everything gets crazy out of hand. The only difference is that I feel like that character's way more clever than I am, and like he's a fumbling fool and he's way more clever than I am. So basically where he like manages to like kill people and get away with it and nearly killed by drug lords and stuff as he's addicting all these people to a crazy powerful chemical, I'd basically would just sell cheap meth and then get killed and my family would fall apart, you know, which just like is even more stressful, really.
I've been told that that's the next one I should watch because they said it's amazing. Rumor is it will go down as like one of the best shows ever. That's all I heard. So I have no basis for it yet. But anyways, yeah. Speaking of award-winning shows, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, believe it or not, this week we're not just going to talk about TV, though we will some because, you know, it's the Emmys and whatnot. Like every week, we will be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the companies working for, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and the technology that they are developing. Before we get into the heart of the show, though, James should probably throw out a short disclosure that'll make sure that he gets to keep his job. Yeah!
I work for HP, however, I do not represent HP or any of their opinions during this podcast.
It's important to note. If you'd like to follow us throughout the week while we engage in the social media world, you can follow me on the Twitter. It's my handle is @MatthewDFurlough, or you can go onto the Instagram where I am nextwiggin4, nextwiggin4, as in the younger brother of Ender Wiggin.
Yeah, which if you don't understand what that means, just wait until November, and you will.
Read the book first, though.
Yeah.
Or don't.
I'm trying to get my wife to do that, and she's not. Ender's Game. I know you want to watch it, but I want you to listen to it.
Listen to it and read it!
No. I told you this. So the author, Orson
Scott Card.
Yeah. He did a little interview. So I listened to the audiobook. And he did a little interview at the end of it, which was awesome. And in it, he was like, you know, they were asking him, like, what's the preferred media? And he goes, well, actually, it was designed to be listening to. So he's like, so for you listening, good job. That's what
really?
I wanted. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. That's sort of, yeah, there's, I've read a couple of, I've listened to books like that where you can clearly tell it was meant to be listened to. Once you listen to it, you're like, oh, this is so much better.
Yeah, so when he wrote it, he had in mind that people would listen to it, which is kind of weird in the sense that, like, he wrote it before audiobooks were really a big thing.
Right, and he wrote it for, like, 20-something-year-olds, not...
Well, yeah, and let's be honest about this whole thing, he didn't write the book to be a standalone for itself. It's actually, he wrote it because he wanted to write a different book, and it just so happens that this one was much better.
Speaking for the dead, if y'all are are not aware, I wouldn't say it's much better. I'd say it has much wider appeal. I think Speaker for the Dead is kind of amazing in its own right, but it's just a very, it's very different. Hey, you know what? Back off. Anyways, so did you give your
yes
your social media information?
I didn't. Why not?
Because you got distracted with by Ender's Game.
Oh, I did. Oh yeah, next weekend. That's right. That's where that came from. I am not trying to emulate some famous book character, soon to be famous movie character. I am simply found at jamesfurlow.com or at James Furlow on Twitter or James Furlow on Facebook or on Instagram or Google Plus or, yeah.
Cool.
LinkedIn. Google. Don't look me up there. Come on. This is a tech podcast.
LinkedIn. Who does? Unless you're about to offer us a crazy, like, high-paying job.
Which case, follow
not
me.
To, let me say, not to mention the fact that nobody uses LinkedIn. Like, seriously.
Well, I kind of use it.
I use it in that I feel like I should use it, but I don't know anybody that this is gonna get way into the weeds, way more in the weeds than I want to. But I think the reality of it is that it is something that everybody feels like is a good idea, but does not even get into the same ballpark of what it was intended to be. You know, it was like, it was intended to be this great place for people to connect and look at each other's resumes and be, you know, boost each other and talk about each other and allow you to leverage technology in order to create a network of jobs whereby you can recommend people for jobs or get jobs or do your LinkedIn business. And I don't know anybody that actually uses it that way.
Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
They recently implemented a new feature, this like skills tag thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get emails all the time now from people giving you like, oh, they're good at this?
Yeah, and people who have absolutely no right knowing whether or not I'm good at it.
Thank you. Because it used to be where it was like you have a job position, you write about it, and then you know, someone can give you a recommendation. And you know, I've only got like a couple. It wasn't anything amazing. And I gave a few. But you know, it took work because you actually had to like say something about the person.
Right.
And then LinkedIn rolled out this, which I was like, you know, that's a cool thing to make it searchable with your skills and then have other people – be like, oh yeah, I know that this person's good at it. But like you said,
for all of those that are listening that have, you know, looked at my skills and said, yeah, he's good at that. I appreciate it. I really do because I feel like it's necessary. The only problem is that I know I've gone through and like bumped people's skills up, but like they've got to be good at that, right? I mean, why wouldn't they be good at it? I've never seen them actually do it, but you know, and even within my own field, like I have engineering friends that I know that went to school. I never took a mechanical design class with them. I never saw them do any mechanical design work, but I'm like, sure, I'll bet they're good at SolidWorks. We all were, right? You know, it's like, what the heck? Like,
but yeah, the weird one is when like it's it's like your cousin.
Yeah,
like, he's awesome at SolidWorks.
That's exactly my point, is that, like, I actually went to school
just with these people. Just for the record, I don't know if any of our cousins actually did it. I just tried to find an example where they
I know.
No, I'm just...
Yeah, but I know what you mean, where it's like, I guess what my... Yeah, my point was is that you know, it's... I should know, and I'm qualified to judge whether or not Sonny's good at it or not, and I am admitting right now that I wasn't qualified because I didn't actually see them use it, but I'm just assuming they are, and, you know, maybe they'll say I'm good at programming. Why would they know? They've never seen me program, but it'll help me out, right? And so it's like...
Or my favorite is sometimes I'll get endorsed for something, and I'll be like, really, you think I'm good at that? That's cool.
Yes.
I don't think I am. So all that to say, that was even, like, not even my main point. I was just now curious. So it's good to know that, yeah, it happens, and clearly that has diluted the value of that. But, you know, that's LinkedIn's problem, not mine. But here's the secret. Here's the secret. If you want to know how to use LinkedIn effectively.
Okay, tell me.
Now, what I'm going to tell you to do is not easy.
Okay, good.
That's the way to do it. It is you use LinkedIn to connect virtually or digitally, whatever, online, and then what you do is you take that offline. Okay, so here's what happens to me. Someone will invite me to connect because I rarely invite other people because that's who I am. But someone will invite me to connect, and I would say like 95% of the time I will accept their connection. There's only those weird ones where you're like, I don't know who you are, and B, you seem kind of scammy, so no. Because I'll take the time to look at their thing. And then what I will do is I will read through their, you know, their thing, right? Find something interesting, and then I will write on that invite when they're like, has invited you connect? I'll reply back to them, and I will first be like, hey, read this about your profile. That's pretty darn cool. I'll maybe ask a question, hey, tell me more about what does it mean to do this? And then I'll actually make an offer and say, hey, you know, here's some things that I'm good at. Let me know how I can help you, whether that's making a connection, making some sort of recommendation, answering a question for you, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I'll be like, and, you know, feel free to call or email at any time. And so I would say 90% of the time, they always write back saying, oh, yeah, let me tell you more about what it is that I do. And it starts that, you know, that opens up that opportunity to talk about their job and what they're doing and stuff like that. And I would say, oh, it's probably not 50% of the time, but, you know, it's more than you would expect. Those people be like, oh, cool, thanks for that offer. Actually, I would love help doing this. And then a percentage of those, I actually do end up meeting them for in person, going out to get hot chocolate or something, and just talking about learning their lives. And so, I know, because I don't do coffee. But it's this idea of you can take LinkedIn, this online thing, and then create a genuine real relationship where you help meet a need and do that. So that's how you're supposed to use LinkedIn. That's actually the way that the founder, Reid Hoffman, recommends people do it as well.
Interesting. That's good to know that I'm not going to use it correctly.
There you go. On our show plan, which is awesome. But go ahead.
I'm
going
to say, yeah, because we've got so much to talk about this week. You know, but I am going to throw this little anecdote in there today because I got lunch today at the Togo's near me. For those of you who aren't on the West Coast / this local area, it's a sandwich shop, much akin to your Quiznos or your Subways, but way better quality.
Way better. They got hot pastrami number 9.
Oh, man. And it's way better than Quiznos. That's the thing that gets me is everyone's like, Quiznos, it's like the rich man's Subway. No. You don't even know what you're – like Quiznos can't survive here because Togo's just – beats it in the face. I don't know why it's on a national chain. I love the place. Anyways, and they've got, like, healthy options. That's the crazy part. They've got, like, you know, decently, you know, I'm, you know, trying to be all, like, svelte and stuff.
So you don't have the pastrami sandwich then?
Not very often. No, it's
delicious. It's delicious.
Their chicken sandwiches out of this world is so good, and it's, like, 450 calories. It's nuts. Anyways, the long and short of this is the one that's local to me, there's this kid there that's, like, I want to help this kid get a better job because frequently I go there, he works and he knows my name. He knows what I do. He knows what kind of music I like. He knows that I just bought a car last weekend and I came in today and he goes, how's this car treating you, man? I was like, actually, I just got it up and running. I'm like, this kid is on fire. This kid, remember, he's got a good memory. He's friendly. He's like, he is a people person extraordinaire. He likes music. Like, okay, I've now decided that I want to help this kid get ahead. But I have nothing to do. Like, what it's like, do you know how to engineer stuff? No, that's not what I'm into. Okay.
But that's the kind of thing where, you know, what I would do in that situation, this is for the bros on jobs, you know, you ask them, well, what are you interested in doing? And, you know, if they don't know that question, which happens, you often say, like, okay, let's just say that you're independently wealthy. You had more money than you knew what to do with, and more importantly, didn't have to work to get that money. You just kind of had it now. Okay, what are you going to do? You know, what do you do with your life? What do you do with your time?
And Grand Theft Auto 5.
Sorry, what?
Spy Grand Theft Auto 5.
Well, so what's interesting about that is you'll get two answers, right? It's something big or a bunch of things that they're going to buy, and then travel. I want to see the world, right? Those are the two, like, main answers. And so what you got to do is you got to get past that. I go, okay, fine. You bought Grand Theft Auto. You bought Grand Theft Auto 5. You played it. You beat it. Great. You traveled the world. Now what? What are you going to do to fill your time? What are your hobbies? What do you enjoy doing? And that's where they go, oh, I get it. You find out whatever that is if they don't have the answer. And then you try to see if you know someone who might be interrelated in that field. I knew a guy. He was interested in doing, like, copywriting type stuff, getting into editing words. I'm not great with words, so I'm not your man. But I had met somebody. He actually worked for Google, and then he started up his own company doing, like, he called them word massaging. So not like full on editing, but, you know, working on, you know, helping you just phrase things better, whatever. And so I hooked the two of them up. They had a great conversation. It was awesome. And it helped him decide, okay, this isn't really what I want to do with my life. Right. And he moved into a different direction, which, you know, was awesome. And that's what it's about. So that's one of the things, thinking about your friend. Yeah, you know what? He may not be a mechanical engineer, but that's totally fine. He may be into something else. And I'm willing to bet that you know someone, or at least someone you know knows someone
who can help.
That can, at the very least, just have a conversation. Tell them what was one thing that was surprising about your job or your industry. How does one get into that?
Right. Cool.
Facilitator. I will do that. Connector. So I know you like to be a maven, not a connector, so that's a weird thing for you. I know, but you can do it.
I know. So, okay,
do we actually want to talk about tech? I could talk about this all day long, too.
I know you can, which is why I have to break this off. Okay, so we have all a friend. Do you remember Miranda Henley?
I remember Mexico. Miranda, yeah.
Mexico.
Orange hair, right? Am I thinking of...
Orange hair? No. Maybe at some point.
Blonde?
I think she's blonde. Doesn't matter. Not particularly.
Is that a picture on this?
No. But it's not particularly important. But she was quite a bit younger than us. But this is, I just wanted to bring this up because I thought it was I saw the article on Reddit. And I was like, and it was about cord cutters, and I was like, okay, this is cool, because the big statistic that they drop in this is the idea that this year over year, there are fewer cable subscribers than there were year over year. It's the first time cable subscriptions have dropped ever. Yeah, so it's like you've definitely hit the peak.
I got a sound for this.
Okay.
Here we go.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's the only sound I got. So
it's perfect. Did you like the never mind.
That's a good look. I like it.
Yeah, thank you. Was it worth going on the YouTube and checking out that clip? Anyways, So I'm on Reddit. I'm one of my sources for news, and I was like, wow, that's crazy. I got to check this out. So I put it onto my reading list, since I was on the iPhone and I didn't have time to read it. And then I come back like later in the week to read it on Safari on my Mac. It's kind of cool. This all like, it's weird. It's cool now that we're like at this place where like everything's thoroughly connected, pretty much no matter what you're using, whether it's Google or your iPhone or whatever. I've got all these bins where I put articles now that I'm like, okay, remember to read that. But I open it up and it's like first line of the article is what? No, that's oh, what the heck? That is. Did I click on the wrong? Oh, I clicked on the wrong one. I was like, what the heck? Sorry, this is, I'm not prepared. So the first words are, Miranda Henley spends 4 hours in front of the TV every day, but she does not pay a dime on cable or satellite programming. I was like, recognize that name. Like, how many Miranda Henleys are there out there? So I threw it into the Facebook.
I'm impressed you knew her last name there.
Well, I don't know why I knew her last name, but I threw it on the Facebook because I knew I was friends with her.
She was cute, if I remember correctly.
So, okay, you want to know how I remember her, like, how I describe her? It's like, how I describe her is she makes you seem short-term-minded, unfocused, undedicated, and just, you know, don't know what you're going to do with your life. She was insane, and her just like, why do you do what you do? Well, because it'll set me up for this in 5 years, which will set me up for this in 10 years, which will set me up for this in 30. Oh, like it's, ooh, you have a plan and goals. Okay, you're like,
what's that feel like?
Yeah, you're like 14. Weird. She's the kind of girl that like, and one of the most like the biggest things that I remember is she wore sunscreen every day, and you're like, why do you wear sunscreen every day? She goes, well, I'm not nearly as tan as I'd like to be, but it's better than getting sun cancer and wrinkles. So when I'm older, I think I'll be much better off than everybody else. I was like, once again, you're 14. Like, what the heck is going on here? Anyways, so I've always kind of suspected one of the reasons why I wanted to be friends with her on Facebook is because I always kind of expected, like, one day this girl's going to be somebody, and, like, I want to, hey, remember me? That's right. Yeah, like, pull me along, please. And
I'm
so,
not her friend on Facebook, but I have 11 mutual friends. So
yeah, that's not shocking either. But she, so yeah, I'm like, I'm all of a sudden I'm reading this article. I was like, whoa, it's Miranda. Basically, the long and short of the article is that, and the important part, kind of, this goes with the Emmys and what's it called? And this subscription thing going on and the future
cutting.
Of Netflix. Yeah, the whole cord cutting thing. It's this really weird world, especially with the idea of, like, as you were talking about House of Cards earlier, like in that one video we played where they were talking about the fact that, and we've talked about this like 100 times now, the idea that, like, you're changing the format. What is TV? What are TV series? Are they just really long form movies? What makes a TV show? And so, you know, I make the joke about a dying media type, but it really is. I mean, you know, in 20 years, you know, why would you have 30-minute to an hour-long syndicated every week TV shows? Maybe you'll have some sort of syndication where they come out on a regular basis, but length and timing and all that just kind of goes up in the air to what can you do? What do you want to do? And it becomes as much, you know, especially with, like, as YouTube gets bigger and better and more awesome. You know, it's one of those things where it's just a very it's weird. It's a weird world where we're heading into, especially with watching Emmys, because, like, the big faces that they kept showing were main character of Arrested Development, main character of Netflix, that was a Freudian slip, of House of Cards. You know, because they realized that those were two of the most popular shows on television last year, and they weren't on TV. You know, they didn't have a normal TV cycle at all. And Netflix is starting to compete big time. Where what TV show was it I was looking at? I'm not gonna remember. But there was, like, now networks are having to compete with Netflix because Netflix is like, this is working for us. We are getting subscribers for this. You know, and they're throwing down some serious money to get the next season of whatever show.
Kind of reminds me of when Apple changed their iTunes icon, because it used to be a CD with a music thing,
right.
And eventually they were like, you know what, this doesn't make any sense anymore, so we're just going to make it the music thing in a circle.
Right.
You know, and it's a similar deal where it's like, yeah, it's TV, but eventually it won't make sense anymore. And you just, it's like, I don't know if you noticed it, but YouTube has changed their icon.
Yeah.
They've gotten rid of the TV looking thing. And it's, I mean, it's still an oval, you know, rounded corner oval. But it's just got a play thing in it now. So it's not, you know, like I said, they're getting away from the television metaphor. Yeah. It's like, no, it's totally different. That's interesting.
It's just another monitor. It's just another screen.
And if she's as smart as you remember her, if she's doing it, it's probably a good sign.
Yeah. That's, I don't actually believe that she spends four hours in front of the TV every day. I think she said that / the reporter said that to make it, you know, to get the point across, but I don't believe it at all. but yeah, no, it's very cool. And you know, one of those, it's always weird when you like see Friends on, you know, articles written, you know, like, you know, this is actually like a serious news site out of like New York that makes it to the top of Reddit. It's about one of your friends. Weird. It's a small, big world. Yeah. But she's not the only friend that happened to me this week, but I'll talk about that one later. Cause
yes. I am excited for you to share about that.
Yeah.
Before we talk about that, I want to talk about, I think it's Scout. I want to talk about Scout.
Talk to me.
It's the Lockitron of security alarms.
Okay.
So I remember Lockitron is the thing that I ordered, and I'm still waiting for because I have this bad habit of buying things that take forever to get here. And but it's okay. It's okay. So Lockitron opens up doors, you know, via eventually my phone. And so I just walk up to it, and it's like, oh, you're home. The master's home. And what is it in Back to the Future? The Lord of the Castle.
Yeah.
Anyways, so this company out of, I think it's Sunnyvale, they are making something called Scout, which is security alarms. And what's cool about it is it's this internet thing. Internet-based alarm system, and you know, it does what it does. What's neat about it is it's modular. Okay, that's the big thing. Where if you know, how do I want to say this? They're easy to install on your doors and your windows and stuff like that. So if you're a renter, you don't have to get your house. You don't have to destroy the place in order to put in the system. So yeah. That's super nice. And then the other thing that it'll do is, like, say there is an intruder, it will alert you on your phone, and then it will make some sort of noise as well to try to scare the person. Because the other problem is usually it's expensive to install these alarm systems because, like I said, they got to, like, you know, go through walls and do whatever. And the way that the alarm companies get around that heavy fixed cost up front is they say, well, do a 2-year or a 3-year or whatever license or subscription, I guess, to their security program. So when, you know, when an intruder comes in, they get alerted, they tell the police, or they have someone come check it out for you.
Right.
So this doesn't do that. It just straight up alerts you. Hey, there's someone here. And if you want to do something about it, you can.
Call the police.
Yeah. But it was a cool little, I'm kind of like, you know, as a landlord, I'm like, wow, this would actually be really cool to give to tenants to say, hey, you know what? Here's a system that you can, you know, that you can use and, you know, have. The other interesting thing about these guys is that they have the money. They're making it. but they wanted to gauge the interest in it. So they wanted to do a crowdfunding campaign via the Kickstarter. Okay?
All right.
The only problem is they got rejected.
By Kickstarter?
Yep.
Or they didn't make enough money.
No, they got rejected. Kickstarter would not let them list it, just like they wouldn't let them list Lockitron, apparently. When I pre-ordered Lockitron, I did it on the Lockitron website. And what happens is Kickstarter classified it as a home improvement thing, and they don't fund those for some reason.
Weird.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Go? I was like, all right, well, yeah. So, well, what they ended up doing was they just straight up put it on their own website, and then they used Amazon as the charge thing, which is exactly what Lockatron does. So when I bought it, Amazon verified my card and my name and stuff, but then they won't actually charge me until it ships. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they don't get the cash ahead of time, but you know, assuming they make it and they sell it, they will. And for them, they're like, we've already got the money. We're already making it. We were just trying to gauge interest in this thing. Is it worth to keep going? So they ended up raising $190,000 in 30 days, which was $10,000 more than what their goal was. And since then, they have now raised, it looks like, a little under $350,000. Not bad. But like I said, they haven't spent a penny of it because they already had $100,000 seed money, which is cool. So,
one of the things I think is broader points that I want to make on this is that I spend a lot of time thinking about home automation. And if you remember, like last year, I spent a lot of time echoing the idea that I think home automation is the next big one. I think that's the next big expansion area. You're not talking about you're not talking about heavy mechanization. You're talking about a lot of data acquisition.
Yeah, totally.
Small control systems, or I should say low invasive control systems, lights, temperature, a lot of gaining extra data, and maybe some light mechanization with, like, you know, windows and doors and stuff. But I think that there's a lot of different areas to do that. And one of the big questions that I kept coming back to was, you know, like, is this a complete package that you sell somebody and you got different levels of it and you have to build it into new houses? You have to retrofit houses, or is it, you know, because doing it in a modular format where one system does your locks, one system does one is your Nest thermostat, one is your lights, one is this. It just didn't seem very practical, and it was just like, man, it falls so short of the potential of having one app that controls your entire house and everything's all unified. And one of the cool things that, you know, happens with the computer technology is that you start small and everybody's going, well, I can't do locks, but I can do temperature, and I can't do temperature, but I can do lights, and somebody else is already doing lights, but I can do security, and everybody's coming in it and they're like, and we can't expect you to upgrade your house every time. So we'll do it modularly. We'll do it wirelessly. And it's more expensive that way because the wireless part of it is expensive and everything has to be able to communicate wirelessly. But the thing is, because you can buy it modularly and you can spread that expense over time, it becomes more affordable and it's not as much of a time commitment. So all of a sudden you're having this explosion of different stuff. And so my prediction is that what you're eventually going to have is you're going to start to see more consolidation in the field as different people start opening up different, like, this is our API. Any app can, or, you know, licensed apps can call on this API, and then somebody will write a home automation app that will work with Nest and will work with Philips and will work with Lockatron and will work with all of these different companies. And, you know, and so what you'll end up having is, yeah, everybody will be retrofit. And what'll be interesting is that houses will not get this, like, house builders will not get this, like, super upgraded, we put, you know, control systems into everything. Because there won't be any point. That won't be the foundations of the technology. It'll be stuff that doesn't require wires, which is, like, honestly surprising to me. They'll still wire it up with power, but communication will start to happen wirelessly.
Right.
I think that it's just fascinating. That's definitely the direction that we're going on this one. And it's like, yeah. I don't know why I didn't really think through it because it, you know, well, I was kind of hoping that there'd be a, like, one kill all solution because that's what I want, and I want it faster. And I think you'll eventually have an equivalent solution to that, but it'll all be done modularly. It's very cool. But.
Yeah. So it's neat. So Scout, you go to scoutalarm.com. You can pre-order now for $120.
Boom.
When will it actually be shipping? Let me see here. Dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. Power goes out. Matter slash. What if I lose my phone? Scout. Dun, dun, dun. Doesn't say. I'm sure it does. I'm just not reading it closely enough. But yeah, it's cool. I like it. Before we move on, we need to have a moment of silence.
for
the Nintendo visionary Hiroshi Yamauchi.
Yeah.
Who died at the ripe old age of 85, right on target for average.
I almost bought a 3DS XL today in honor of him.
Instead, you chose to dishonor him and not buy it?
Yeah, I feel bad about it. I actually might go and... You know what? Now that I've said it out loud, I'm like, I can make it to Target before they close after the podcast. Pokemon. It'd be a terrible idea. Don't let me do that.
So he was awesome. Yeah. He was the guy who took Nintendo from a trading card company to what it is today. Since 2003, I think. So he was the guy who, who said, I think video games are the next wave of awesome. Turned out to be right.
Yeah.
Which is cool. So he was, he oversaw the NES, the Super NES, the N64, and the GameCube.
Wow.
Just the NES, if that was all that he did, you'd be like, whoa, he was also, the dude who was, he recruited, or how do I want to say this? Shigeru Miyamoto.
I'm going to say he and Miyamoto are the legends of Nintendo, because Miyamoto was responsible for Zelda, Metroid, most of the Marios,
Fox. Yeah. Well, and Donkey Kong, the original arcade.
That's right. Yeah. Donkey Kong.
That was his first one, actually.
Super Mario Bros. Yeah. Legend of Zelda 64, Ocarina of Time. Pikmin, Metroid.
Yeah, so yeah, those two did a lot together. So yeah. He was in control of the company until 2002, and then he left the board in 2005, and it's kind of because he got old.
Yeah,
I guess is the way to put it. So an obvious loss. He spawned. I mean, sure, you could say it was Atari, I suppose, but I would say that he spawned what I would still call the current generation of console video games.
Yeah, he was a big deal.
He took a mainstream, made it whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. He made it acceptable to have it in your house,
He made it awesome.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. So, bummer. But, he was 85, definitely. Lived a good life, wasn't struck by some fruitarian diet thing.
Oh, jeez.
So it's okay.
Yeah.
Bummer.
Speaking of
hopefully his, here comes the dig. Hopefully his legacy will last longer than 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely hope for that.
It will, just may not in its current form.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Nintendo. I'll bet they're not done kicking yet. So speaking of that particular brand of fruit that you made reference to a moment ago, Apple launched a new product this week. I don't know if you followed that at all. / were bombarded by it. Yeah,
really?
It was crazy.
Huh.
So one of the cool articles that I read, a couple from Monday / late weekend, there's this big question overhanging the launch, and it's still not been answered as far as I can tell, which is crazy. But this is the big question. Who is making the A7?
I thought it was Samsung.
Everybody thought it was Samsung until they actually started looking into it. Because if you remember correctly, at the end of last week, we did our basically, hey, go buy the iPhone show, and I made a comment in reference to Samsung stepping up immediately the week after and saying, oh, no, or a few days later saying, no, don't worry, we're working on a 64-bit phone. Our next phone's going to be 64.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, a lot of people did some digging, and they're like, you guys. weren't planning on making a 64-bit phone. There is no reason for you to make a 64-bit phone. What the heck are you talking about? Why are you making such a big deal, like, echoing this? And these are, like, the king copycats, right? And if they can copycat before somebody, you know, like, if, I don't know, there were rumors that a particular fruit company were going to make some sort of a iWatch, what would they do? A few months before the other company launched it, they would launch their own and call it the Galaxy Gear. This is just like par for the course for them, and they seemed to be a little bit caught off guard by the 64-bit processor, which piqued people's interest because both of these companies are pretty tight-lipped about it. And what's going on? Why both are pretty tight-lipped about this. Like, who's manufacturing what? TSMC, the Taiwanese Semicon Manufacturing Corp, definitely is going to start making silicon for Apple in 2014. But that's kind of what everybody expected.
Yeah.
But Samsung was supposed to have all manufacturing rights through to the end of 2013. That definitely included the A6, which is what runs the iPhone 5C and the iPhone 5. And the 4S, actually. They're making all the silicon for that. Definitely, no question asked. Which makes sense. So the big question everybody was asking was, like, so Samsung, why were you caught off guard by the production of the A7? Why didn't you know the 64-bit thing was coming? And what's really important here is, in order to fit the number of transistors that Apple has fit onto the chip, it requires a 22, or it's, I think they said it was a sub-24, so 22-23 nanometer process. They could go as small as 20. That would make sense. But you're tooling up way too much. You're doing the unnecessary work for that small of a chipset. And the thing is that Samsung not tooled up for that scale at all. But neither was TSMC. Really and truly, there's only one fab in the world that people are sure of that is tooled up to
Intel.
Make. Yep.
I'm just guessing.
It's Intel. And so they were like, so somebody, either Apple has a secret deal with Intel, which is possible.
That would be so awesome.
Yeah, I know.
The opera's on.
I know. Or Apple has secretly tooled up somebody else. Because the thing is that, you know,
either way, it's juicy. I love it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the thing. If Samsung did the tooling up to be able to do that scalar process, it would have had to be a huge cash infusion or a cash investment on their part, one of the two. It would take months to do. Even if Apple, like, kept it very close to the chest, what they were doing to the very last minute, they'd have at least like 5 months of buying tools. And honestly, I think that this is, like, way underselling how big of a deal this is. As somebody who builds Semicon tools, I can tell you what the time frame is. The day, let's say you want to start manufacturing on September, you have to be quoting in December of the year before, because it takes about a month to get really and truly, as you go through all the quoting process, it takes a month. You got to give the companies 3 months to build the tools. They can ship it in a week, but usually you ship it in within 3 to 4 weeks. Once it's there, it takes a month to get installed and get qualified by the company. Once it's qualified by the company that made it, then the company's got to qualify it. You're up to 6 months right now. Now, that doesn't include all the other tools in the process. If everything goes as planned, you're talking fastest that you can get a fab up and running is 6 months. Usually, you give yourself about 9. That's when people are like, if their goal is to get it done in 9, you start tooling up 7 about, or if your goal is to, yeah, you start tooling up about 9 months before you think you need to, which is a huge endeavor. And the idea that Samsung wouldn't know that there was a 22-nanometer process coming, and that it was coming from Apple, and that word hadn't gotten from the Semicon group over to the handheld group at some point and said, oh, we're making 64-bit phones. It's just insane that wouldn't have happened. Because I guess there were a couple of other indicators where people were like really looking into it, and it definitely appears that Samsung was caught off guard. They did not know, which is awesome, because that means somebody else got a contract that nobody saw. And what's really interesting, the other big piece of evidence that people said was that, if you remember, there were a couple of rumors that the expectations for sales on the iPhone, the future iPhones, were low. And the reason for it was because Apple was cutting back production through Samsung. The number of chips they were ordering was being really scaled back, as though the new phone was going to sell, new set of phones was going to sell terribly. And so that had an appreciable effect on their stock price. It really hurt their stock price. And then all of a sudden everybody came back and said, well, they based that report on the assumption that Apple was only going to be getting chips from Samsung. And if they were only getting chips from Samsung, then yeah, that's a much smaller, you know, number of phones. But if they were only getting chips for Samsung for the 4S and the 5C, well, that's actually more phones than you would expect. That was a good indicator, and it would indicate that they were getting the A7 from somebody else. My money is on that it was TSMC. That they started tooling up with TSMC about 6 to 7 months ago, and that they dropped a ton of cash. And I am willing to bet it started 2 years ago. 2 years ago, there was a quarterly report, number two, that Apple was talking about doing huge investments, capital investments, in equipment. And it doesn't make any sense. There's a couple of areas where they clearly could have been tooling up for different stuff, but manufacturing tooling up for like the cases of the iPhone, that doesn't cost that kind of money. And it's not that long term of an investment. Those tools, they build them faster, they get qualified faster. 22-nanometer processes, though, that stuff takes forever. And I'll bet Apple started dumping cash into this process 2 years ago, knowing that they were going to be doing a 64-bit, and the only way to get it onto that size of a die was to do a 22-millimeter process. And you're going to find out very soon here that TSMC is all up in that junk, and which is really cool. And the other thing is that, you know, that a lot of people, you know, this is just in case you care about the drama on Wall Street, which, why would you? It doesn't affect anybody except the super rich investors.
Like me.
Exactly. But the big thing on why did Apple's stock drop like a rock right after the announcement.
It always does.
Well, it always does, but it actually dropped. Right? It got hit harder than normal.
Okay.
And especially weird considering the fact that like a week later, it jumped up more than people expected. Like, just expectations were totally off. And what they were saying was, I thought was really interesting. Originally, they said it got hit because of the cheap iPhone. Well, they expected it to be less. And yeah, that's probably true. They missed expectations on that. But there's a lot of investors that were like, actually, we were totally thrown off by the 64-bit processor because we didn't know what to make of that. We're like, why would you do that? What advantage does that give you? Nobody else is doing that. We didn't expect this to come. And this goes to Tim Cook can keep secrets that you were talking about last week, and the dedication going back to keeping secrets and delighting people with surprises. Nobody saw that the 64-bit processor coming. It just came completely out of left field, and it took a week and a half for people to go, this is a big deal. And what's really cool about it is they were saying that they're like, Apple didn't need to do the 64-bit processor to get the speed bumps that they got. What they needed to move over to was what's called AV8 architecture. Oh, shoot. I know this. It's the ARM. Ooh.
I don't know it, so it's all on you.
Yeah, ARM AV8. Trying to type in such a way that it won't.
Yeah, cut off your sound. You know, the stuff that I was reading you know, a lot of it too was this uncertainty around the Touch ID. They're like, we think it's cool, but we don't know. But it, you know, and now it's, and now it's, you know, a week later, which is kind of amazing. People have gotten to play with it, and they're like, oh, this is actually really cool. It's just interesting how it's the, you know, you get that, that tech echo chamber at the very beginning, because it's just the bloggers who have touched it who are picky and, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then it's, and then customers actually start touching it and playing with it, and all of a sudden, like, whoa, this is actually really cool. And, you know, and they're like, this is the best phone ever. Like, well, there you go. Which it has been. The 5S has been getting some pretty cool critical reviews. And the 5C will just probably continue to sell well, even though no one's really talking about it anymore.
Right. So basically, and yeah. So basically what I was going to say was, what's cool about this is that, that Apple basically, they implemented a new, what it actually is your most basic binary sets, your basic coding language. The architecture, the silicon architecture is designed to execute machine code, right? And right. So the machine code, they were working on a legacy machine code, the 7th version of it, that had all this 32-bit compatibility, and there was all sorts of silicon that you had on there that basically was designed to keep all of this legacy architecture going.
Okay.
And it was not very fast. and the latest one was a complete rewrite that got rid of the 20 years of legacy code. It would give you huge, huge performance boosts, and it worked with 32-bit processors. The thing was, it was designed for 64-bit processors. Well, the thought was that everybody was going to move over to the new code set with 32-bit processors, because there was no reason to go to 64. Because the thing is that they said you actually get a better performance boost by just going to the new machine code and not going to 64-bit. Well, Apple decided to get all crazy and jump to 64-bit because they're like, we get this huge performance boost, and then we scale it back a little bit, but now we're on the 64, as opposed to what everybody else was going to do, which was get the huge performance boost, and then when they go to 64, you don't get a performance boost anymore. And now they're completely ready for 4 gigs of RAM plus, and all the other different crazy, you know, advantages you get with having a 64-bit architecture.
Which is why I'm so happy I held out on my iPhone.
Oh, baby.
Or maybe, do you think it'll be for the iPad that actually will have the space for a bigger memory chip?
I think the iPads will get them first, yeah, probably.
That'd be my guess. Yeah. You think the iPads will get the Touch ID, just out of curiosity?
I don't know. Probably.
I think the big one, yes, the Mini.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd agree.
That's my opinion.
I'd agree with that.
Okay. Another way to differentiate them.
Yeah, exactly. So this is really fascinating. But the last point I wanted to bring up on this is that as people have actually like sat down and talked about it, I referenced this as sort of like a forward-thinking guess, but everybody's basically come together and said no. The 64-bit processor that Samsung has announced they're going to build, it's going to be essentially the ultimate hoax 64-bit processor. It's going to be a 64-bit processor that runs a Linux kernel, a Unix kernel, that virtualizes a 32-bit Unix kernel.
Brilliant.
That runs the 32-bit Delvik, and which runs 32-bit Android. It's going to be all 32-bit. There's no 32-bit Android. You can't run technically you can run a virtual machine of that would run Delvik, but it's a 32-bit virtual machine. It's so stupid. Ah. And they're basically like, it is going to be one of those things where they're going to put it in there just to say they have it.
Yeah,
and it's going to be a performance hit. And the other thing I wanted to bring up here was that Samsung had this has been working on this other phone, the Octa 8-core processor that they didn't launch in America. Because the Galaxy S4 came with the Snapdragon, the quad core, and which is a great chip made by Nvidia. And then they have their Octa, which like they wouldn't launch in America, which really upset Americans. And And, you know, and everybody was like, why would you do that? And then when people actually got the Samsung chip, they started to realize why. It's because it's a huge battery drain, and it's just a terrible. So Samsung basically, if Samsung, this goes back to the idea Samsung didn't have the order for the A7, because while Samsung was getting ready to build an 8-core chip, they would have also been tooling up to build the dual core 64-bit processor. It just doesn't make any sense for Samsung to have misread it so bad, especially when, you know, all of a sudden everybody's going to be following, chasing this thing down. You know, the 64-bit. And this is my prediction. I do want to say my predictions. My prediction is this. Google's going to launch KitKat. Yep. Very next version of Android, the big thing is it's going to run on a 64-bit kernel. Samsung is going to have the 64-bit chip before that's done. And they're just going to virtualize it and say, now it's upgrade ready, which nobody will ever upgrade because nobody ever upgrades their Samsung phones. Because Samsung doesn't support it very well. But they'll be able to say it can do it. Google is going to announce that that's what they're working on long before they debut it, but they're going to launch it within a year. And within a year, you're going to see your first, I'd say within 12, I'd guess within 10 months, you'll see your first full-blown 64-bit Android device, definitely within 16 months. And 16. You'll see that.
That's kind of a random number.
16, I'm in 18, year and a half. Okay. Without a question. I think it'll be within a year, but it might take a year and a half.
Yeah.
But the big thing will be that the big thing for me is that BlackBerry will never see a 64-bit phone. Wow. They won't even announce it. But the big one for me will be what's Nokia / Microsoft going to do about it. Because I think what's going to happen is all of a sudden there's a new tech race a specs race that all these other companies love to get into. And, you know, classic Apple where they're like, we're not about specs, but by the way, our specs crush you guys. You know, just
they're not about them until they, you know.
They beat them. And now
right,
they're
always about specs when it's about look at the size of this 0.33333 millimeters.
Exactly.
Know? They love specs on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, when they're beating everybody else, they love it.
And
they're great. And
yeah,
specs are really important.
We'd like to talk about the experience and the philosophy of the device.
Yeah, jeez, Louise. And now they're going to get everybody into a fevered pitch of, but does your phone have 64-bit processors? And I really appreciate the fact that, like, it seems to just be the forums where you got the plebeians that are like, but it doesn't have 4 gigs of RAM. Why would you need 64 bits? But mostly I'm seeing a lot of people anywhere that crops up. You're seeing people knock them down and say, no, there are reasons to have 64-bit beyond that. Especially with Apple's integrated approach where they can tune everything. They can tune the software. They can tune the hardware. They can tune the app, you know, development and all that stuff, so that it all actually takes full advantage of the 64-bit processor without taking advantage of the extra RAM. Very cool, and I'm looking forward to seeing who does it. For drama's sake, I hope it's Intel, but my expectations is that it was TSMC that's doing the manufacturing for Apple. That'll come out sooner than later, I suspect, but very cool.
Agreed. All right, so here's a question.
Okay.
I'm going to give you some stats, and you got to try to guess which company I'm referring to.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
All right, here we go. This will be fun. $995 million were lost last quarter.
Okay.
Million, almost a billion, but not quite.
Not quite. That's an important distinction, because one sounds a whole lot worse than the other.
Yeah, it's kind of like prices, right? Oh, it's only $5.99. It's not $6.
Right.
Sure. So lost a little less than $1 billion. They managed to ship 3.7 million devices in the quarter.
Okay.
Good job, good job.
Yeah,
they will soon cut their operating expenses by 50%. One of the ways they're going to do this is by letting some guys go.
Okay, I realize about, there's 20 questions going on and everything, but does this happen to be a fruit company?
Yes. Fruit company that's share price is down 17% after all these announcements.
Well, and really and truly, let's start here. How much are they down over the last 7 years? Because if I recall correctly, there were two fruit companies, and one was the dominant in its particular niche, and the other one was made fun of by the other one for being out of their league. And it seems to me that I know we've gotten sort of lost in the vagaries of who's at fault here, but it seems to me that this company has taken a pretty big hit in the last 7 years. As we restart our weekly "Oh no, BlackBerry's done it again" segment. Oh, you know what I realized this week? We're not going to get to see Nokia fall. It's a bummer, man.
It's true.
I was like, I was really, you know, I was the shark.
Nokia, by the way.
Nokia, thank you. And I appreciate that. I was the shark, and I could smell blood in the water, and I was excited, man. I was excited. That's right.
Yeah,
Nokia is going down. Nokia is going down. I know. And then all of a sudden, Microsoft picked them up. But you know what this does mean. So I will let us circle back to BlackBerry's tremendous performance in a second.
Tremendous, but, yeah.
But you know what this does mean? That at this point, the next company that seems to be stumbling all over itself and failing. Well, there's two, really. And one of them is heart-wrenching, and I hope pulls it around. The other one's really exciting if it keeps going the way it's going. You got Nintendo, which is heart-wrenching, but if things keep going the way they're going, Microsoft is it's a paper cut in the ocean of sharks. That are and I like how I refer to myself as a shark. I'm a vulture. Like, let's be real here. Like, I'm just somebody else kill it, and then I'll go in and pick up the scraps.
I'm just gonna watch.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in the Colosseum, really. That's what I'm a spectator.
This is fun to watch, but the armor has been broken through, and I think
you think so, huh?
You know, I'm not. I mean, of the two companies, if I had to put money on the two companies, which one's going to die first, it'd be Nintendo, unfortunately.
Yeah, but there was an analyst who came out this week who, by the way, has a sizable share of Microsoft stock, so, you know, take that what you will. But he goes, I think Microsoft is actually a better investment than Apple.
Yeah, of course he does.
And he goes, and his reasons he cited, he goes, they've got fantastic margins on software, which I was like, all right, true. And he goes, and they're mostly in the enterprise, which takes years to turn over their, you know, whatever. Whereas Apple and Samsung are mostly in the consumer space, which can happen in, like, you know, I can't really click right now for some reason. Changes super fast. So Apple could just be, you know, they could be nothing next year, whereas Microsoft will still be around.
Yeah, that's so I'm just saying, stupid.
That's what he came out and said.
That is just...
I was like, yeah, because you don't own stock and have a vested interest in watching that one grow, so we're making up reasons.
I'm going to say, cool. It's just recanting the stupidest of tripe. You know, it's.
I'm just saying, he thinks they're going to be around longer than Apple and Samsung. So,
you know, it's one of those, I come back as soon as one company.
And he's in charge of a fund.
As soon as one company comes up with a Pages or Google Docs equivalent with a Excel equivalent, you're going to watch the end of Office.
Dude, that's Excel, man. That's like, in my opinion, Pages is as good as Word.
It's better in a lot of ways.
I agree with that. It's definitely lighter, which is nice. And, you know, Keynote is fine. You know, I've noticed you don't have to get super technical with PowerPoint presentations. You know, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, for the most part, it's text and pictures, for the most part, pretty straightforward. I would even go as far as to say, you know, the Google presentation stuff is good enough for 90% of what people do.
Yeah.
You know, it works. And I think Keynote's awesome. Actually, Keynote has some features that are really, really nice, in my opinion. But it's, man, it's Excel. And when you're talking about a business, Excel is exceedingly important. It's critical.
And that's why I sit there and go, somebody is going to crack that nut. Somebody's going to sit down and say, I can take on the giant. Some Dave is going to come up and say, I can build a better Excel. And all you'd have to do to build a better Excel is to put it in the cloud for free, you know, and buy the software, and we'll just port it across a couple of different platforms. I mean, Apple's like on the precipice of it. And really and truly,
not really, dude. Numbers is stupid.
On the precipice of it, I mean that all they'd have to do is to get serious about turning numbers into Excel, you know, into making it an equivalent performance device, a heavy-duty number processing tool that, you know, as opposed to a toy for, you know, stay-at-home moms to do budgets.
Well, the emphasis is on presentation. Shocker. You know, Jobs cared more about what it looked like than what it actually did.
Which is
great for PowerPoint, you know, and you could see that, you know, Keynote was awesome because that's what it did. And Pages is kind of like, dude, it is what it is. And the stuff that they always show are presentation related, right? It's like, look, you can move this picture around and the text just figures it out, you know, and so it's all about presentation. And Numbers is that same thing. It's about presentation, which unfortunately makes it completely unusable for anything remotely advanced.
Right, and the thing is, and the thing that I like about Apple right now, what they're doing is, it's like, you know, I've got Pages on my computer, on my Mac, which is awesome. I've got Pages on my iPhone, I've got Pages on my iPad, and then I got iCloud on my PC, and it performs great on all the different platforms. It does exactly what it needs to do. And if you could do that with Excel, oh my gosh. And Excel is kind of a mess when it comes to putting it in a browser. I think you'd have to build a native app for it for every platform, which is, you know, one of the struggles that Google and Apple are coming across. Is Apple doesn't want to make a native platform for Windows, and Google doesn't want to make a native platform for anybody.
Well, and it doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, it's just, you know, on a because you don't really use a keyboard. I mean, I don't know how you use Excel. But like for me, it's you're not typing, you know, and you're not. I mean, sure, you're typing some, but that's not the main emphasis, right? You're writing out functions and, you know, and saying this cell equals that cell, and you're making charts, and I don't know. It would be hard to do on a tablet, I think, but still.
The long and short of this is, BlackBerry is in a death spiral, and.
Yeah,
it's kind of they're coming to the close, man. They're coming to the close. They're firing over 5,000 employees, which is nuts. 40% of the workforce. I mean, they're getting ready to close up.
They were like, oh man, the drain's been unplugged.
Yeah, you know, and now it's just a who's gonna buy them? You know, that's the only question.
Which the fun part is because they're a Canadian company and because of their. Their bias or rules, you know, on foreign takeovers. I don't know if it'll happen, man. I honestly don't know.
Yeah. Well,
by the time it does, there'll be a shadow of what they used to be.
As though they aren't already a shadow of what they used to be. But I mean, it's I agree. I think it'll just be laughable. You'll be buying IP, is it? You'll be buying patents.
Kodak style, yep.
That's all it will be at the end of it all. If they manage to have that happen before bankruptcy, which I don't actually think they will. But it's
so you think they'll make it to the end of this year still? Care to update your thoughts on that? I think they'll make it. I don't know how much cash they have.
Yeah, that's the big thing. How much money do they have on hand?
Let's see here. Google. Oh, can't talk and type at the same time. Not that I can do it. Just Google can't handle it. Let's see here. What's their BB.T? I don't even know what that means. BBRY. Very. Makes sense. Financials. Here we go. Let's go to the balance sheet. Total assets. Should we go with cash, perhaps? All right. So, I don't know. They've got a good. Where's their total assets? So, I mean, they've got $13 billion of total assets. Where am I looking? This is June of this year. That's not their latest, but that's okay. It'll work. So they had $13 billion in total assets. They had $1.5 billion of cash and equivalents. So, and it looks like when you just look at their current assets, which is like short-term assets, they had $7 billion. So, I mean, they still got some assets. They could still make a go of it, but you run into problems where you lose $1 billion. So, okay, now they're down to six.
Yeah. And they're not.
And that's per quarter. And it's, you know, once companies and everyone, you know, they were talking about, like, what did I say? They sold 3.7 billion or...
Million.
3.7 million. They're like, chances are Apple sold at least that many day one.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah, they probably doubled that number over the course of the weekend. And the thing that's going to kill them is it's like, you know, as you run out of money, you keep cutting back. And it's like pretty soon here, their entire fleet of phones is going to be out of date of new phones. And it's like...
Well, that's... And they won't sell anything anymore, and it literally will just be like, all
right. And they won't have any phones to sell. Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a, you know, yeah.
Well, and they're cutting back their workforce, so they're not going to be developing anything new. It's a death spiral. They're in the middle of it. Hopefully none of our listeners own BlackBerry stock, because otherwise, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Should have sold it a long time ago.
Yeah.
That's why you listen to the show, because we told you this. Like, we've been following this since basically day one. It's actually... One of the reasons why we started this podcast was over talks about Palm and BlackBerry. And you remember that back when we first said BlackBerry's next? I mean, I remember when we first talked about the death of Palm and then, like, how it was happening. And it just was like, there's nothing that's going to stop this. We were at that one restaurant up in Oregon. And, and then a few months later, it was like, once Palm's, it still took like a year and a half for Palm to go. Once Palm's fate was sealed, though, it was like, yeah, BlackBerry's after that, man. They got nothing. They got no idea what's coming their way. That's crazy. True. Anyways.
Very true. So, speaking of death spirals, Google has an initiative to try to stop your own personal death spiral.
Oh, man, dying slowly.
Yeah, exactly. They want you to die even slower.
Nice. I appreciate that, Google.
I guess it's the way to look at it. They have announced a new company called Calico, which I looked that up, and that's either a type of cotton fabric or a cat. I don't know what they're referencing. I'm sure there's something meaning behind it. There always is.
Yeah.
But anyways, Google is kind of, this is a subsidiary of them, I guess, is going to be an arm of their Google X project. And this company is focused on health and well-being.
Okay.
In particular, the challenge of aging and associated diseases. And what's super interesting about this is that Arthur D. Levinson, name should sound familiar, because he is the chairman and former CEO of Genentech. And he's the chairman of Apple. This guy is going to be the CEO and one of its founding investors.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. So Larry Page said, illness and aging affects all of our families. With some longer-term moonshot thinking around healthcare and biotech, we believe we can improve millions of lives. It's impossible to imagine anyone better than Art doing what he does. blah, blah, blah. And then even Tim Cook got a little quote in on this Google announcement saying, for too many of our friends and family, life has been cut short, or the quality of their life is too often lacking. And then Art is one of the crazy ones who thinks it doesn't have to be this way. There is no one better suited to lead this mission, and I'm excited to see the results. That's so cool. Google has started this up. And then TechCrunch did a good article. They're like, what is this? And why does Google think its mysterious new company can defy aging? So you talked about how you think that one of the next big things is home security, which or home automation, I should say. You know, which I'm like, yeah, I totally agree, and I think that's a big space, and there will be a lot of investment. I also totally, I believe I even said this on the podcast at some point in time, you know, that tech companies are going to start, the eye is going to move on to healthcare and, you know, the human body, making it better. You know, now that we've got all our different camera filters, it's time to move on to the next thing. And it's starting, which is cool. Yeah. It's already started. You know, but now you got a company with a lot of money who's going after it and, quite frankly, doesn't care if they make any money for a really, 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 really long time.
Well, I don't think they care if they make any money at all. I think they just don't want to die.
Well, that's true, yeah.
Which is, when you look at it that way, there is a completely different mentality to how you spend the money and why. And you, have you seen Elysium yet?
No. Is it good?
I liked it. I mean, you gotta be, all right. You know, it's.
Well, it's so.
Yeah.
I probably will watch it eventually. But so this one paragraph, I think, captures what you're about to say, which is sources tell us that Calico is still very much in the exploratory phases and is seeking neither near-term profits nor has much of any idea about how to actually increase lifespans. So there's that. It's one thing to say we're going to increase the human lifespan by 20 years, and another entirely to actually do that. Fortunately, Page and Levinson aren't the first ones to attempt longevity. Immortality has long been the ambition of kings, supervillains, and pretty much anyone who enjoys waking up each morning.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they're like, yeah, we don't think we'll make any money. We don't even know if we will. We just think this would be a good thing to, you know, go after. What I also thought was really interesting, Page is obviously a very smart person, yeah. In case you haven't figured that one out yet, and he looks at the world a little bit differently, and he does this interview with Time Magazine, and he's like, are people really focused on the right things? They're like, jeez. Wait, what? He goes, one of the things I thought was amazing is that if you solve cancer, you've added about 3 years to people's average life. It's like, okay, big deal. We think of solving cancer as this huge thing that'll totally change the world. But when you really take a step back and look at it, yeah, there are many, many tragic cases of cancer, and it's very, very sad. But in the aggregate, it's not as big of an advancement as you might think. Yes!
Wow.
So he's like, we're trying to find something that'll do it 20 years, not just 3 years. To which I think later on in the article they were like, let's say that you do figure out how to increase people's lifespans. Eventually, that will increase the chances of a mutation happening. So if you want to keep going, you will have to address cancer. So there you go.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm like, okay, yeah, on average 3 years perhaps. But, you know, if you get rid of some of those younger – you know what I mean? I'm like, they'll have to get there.
Well, okay. I mean, the big C is an interesting one because it's not a disease. It's a pathology. It's a
right.
It's a, you know, it's interesting because it's such a bigger conversation. And what I think part of what he's getting at is it's this gigantic, number one, we don't really understand it as well as we'd like to, and there's a lot of doctors that are coming out and saying we're pathologizing it all wrong. I mean, there's not necessarily any reason to get rid of growing tumors. They don't always kill you. And, you know, and we do a lot of stuff, and we I don't know. It's just interesting. There's a lot of different, you know, maybe we need to look at cancer differently. We need to educate people about cancer differently. There is no cure for cancer. People who have been cured of cancer aren't cured of cancer. They're the particular, you know, type of cancer they have is doing this, and it's, you know, there was a good XKCD XKCD comic on this, because there's always a good XKCD comment on whatever topic you're talking about, where he kind of, he maps out what it looks like and why it looks like that. And you know, the path to recovery on, with cancer. And basically I think what Paige is saying is like, there's no magic bullet here. And even if we do crack the nut and really get in, you know, it's going to take a tremendous amount of money, tremendous amount of time. And it's not that it's not a worthwhile cause. It's just that it's a huge, huge endeavor. And statistically, it doesn't do enough. Whereas if we can figure out the telomere thing and how to get over the actual act of aging, or at least delaying it by a significant amount, all of a sudden, we can – he's looking for – what he's saying, I think, is we think there's a silver bullet out there. We think there's a one-shot – we think with one problem, we can add 20 years. Now, there's a whole host of things that you'd have to do. Like, you basically have to solve every uncurable ailment in order to live forever. So let's start with the big ones. Let's start with the exciting ones. Let's stop aging and then stop cancer and then stop heart disease and stop, you know, dementia. Because though that's first comes cancer, then comes heart disease. As long as you're living a healthy life, then comes heart disease, and then finally dementia. So you're like, you know, those are your big four. But the big one, the one that we call all just kind of ignore, putting money towards,
take for granted,
is aging. The fact that you will just die, and that is a different pathology from dementia, from cancer, from heart disease. And how you know that is because they're unrelated to your age. Young people get heart disease. Young people get dementia. Young people get cancer. And so, obviously, aging is its own thing. And, you know, that's one of those ones where maybe we can cure that. Now, what I think is fascinating is Pew did a giant research poll, and they asked tons and tons and tons of people, how long do you want to live? And the basic answer was, 87, 90 years, that'd be cool. Basically nailed the life expectancy, which I think is interesting because, you know, that's one of those ones, you know, which comes – that's a Freakonomics one. Do we think 80, 70, you know, 90 or, you know, 87, 90, is that a good time? Because at that point, you've just been around for so long and everybody's kind of got a sense of, been around a long time. That's good enough. Or is that one of those things where just because that's the life expectancy, would we say 60 sounds long enough if the life expectancy was 60, or would we say 120? You know, so that's it's interesting to say to think that at this.
Well, that's
point,
an easily testable hypothesis, because there's different life expectancies in different countries around the world, and you just ask and see if there's a correlation.
And I think that would be interesting, but I don't know, it's a fascinating question. This one I don't know why, but life expectancy and immortality, this one always freaks me out way more than everything else. Like getting rid of language barriers and bringing the internet to everybody and curing malaria, and I don't know, all that just sounds like really exciting and cool and interesting. But for some reason, getting rid of aging just weirds me out. Like, I don't know, man. That one sounds like the beginning of the zombie apocalypse.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens, because, you know, one of the things Google's going to do, or this company, is they're going to be able to throw data at it, right?
Yeah.
And in some ways, they seem to imply, right, with enough data and the right algorithms, we can crack the code. There are other companies out there that study this stuff all the time, and this is what they do, and they're well-funded. Yeah. I mean, I hate to be this way, but, like, every single pharmaceutical company studies this stuff. Yeah. Now, granted,
Genentech.
Their focus is a little different, but, you know, that's fine. So they're not sure how they're going to go, but there's two different routes that they're thinking about doing. The first one is that there's recently this worm called the planarian. It's a planarian worm. What's cool about it is that when its cells divide, Usually there's some sort of breakdown in the reproduction, and with
The
theirs,
telomeres.
sure, maybe. Their cells don't break down. So if you think about your skin, the reason why it starts to get older is because you have that breakdown in, the DNA and stuff. These worms don't appear to have that. They just kind of keep going forever. So they're kind of like, can we figure out why they're doing that and then splice it in with ours? Which you're like, all right, well, cool. So that's one thing, which again, they're just guessing. And then the other one, is really just doing a hardware solution, right? Replacement of organs or, whatever part of your body. Oh, your heart's failing. No big deal. We'll 3D print you a new one and put it in there, and you're good to go. And so, that might be another one that they go. But this is all, like I said, it's part of the Google X arm. It's going to be a huge, huge project that will take forever. We may never hear anything about it again, but that's just the nature of it. So that's what Google's been up to recently.
That's interesting. By the way, you want to know that one of the reasons why we think that this is all possible, one of the exciting things about this, is when you look at those worms that never die, they're essentially immortal. Their cells keep the telomeres are in an extension of the DNA. That's the part that gets chopped up and shorter and shorter. And statistically, what we see is that those get incredibly short over time, and when you run out of them, you die. And nobody knows exactly why. There's been a lot of good science in the last 10 years that have built actual biomechanical correlations where we sit there and we go, we understand better today than ever before, but there's still no definitive. As they shorten, it causes these side effects, and that's what kills you. It's more of a, we know they get shorter as you die. And I remember back when I was in high school, the big question, which was only 10 years ago, the big question was, do they get shorter because you're dying, or do you die because they get shorter? And in the last 10 years, we've basically come to the point of, you die because they get shorter. That's, one of the big things that we're pretty sure of now. But the exciting part about it is that there are, and every once in a while they'll do, TV shows on this and stuff, there are immortal cell lines, human cell lines, where there are human cells that reproduce ad infinitum, and they're used in all sorts of human bio research because and companies all over the world use them, and there's three people that they come from because for whatever reason they died of something. And when we took their cells, we were like, oh, their cells aren't dying. Why aren't their cells dying? And if you put it in a petri dish, they just keep going. And so what they are is these genetically identical human cells that everybody can do testing on, which is why they're so important for testing. Why everybody uses them, even though they don't really care. They don't care about the particular immortality. What they care about is the consistency. They're the same cells, and they've been the same cells for the last 30 years, even though you're a billion generations away and all over the world. But we know it's possible. We know that for some reason it happens in these cells. There's something genetically going on that the telomeres aren't getting shorter, so the cells keep surviving and keep reproducing over time. And so, I don't know, it's cool. It's very cool. It's exciting. It's one of those things where you sit there and go, it's possible. It's just a big question of how do we get there? And it's cool to see them do this, even if you decide to not live forever. I will say this, I've always had dreamt of living to 113. That's my goal. I want to put one foot in three different centuries if I can. The 90s, the 2000s, and the 2100s. And I got to get to, I got to be, 113 to get there. That's my goal. Let's go, Google. Let's go. we'll see. It's cool. Anyways. That's not important. So that's kind of cool. I'm gonna do a little bit of robot talk because I like robots. Robots are fun.
Now you do.
So two big developments that have been going on in the field of robots. Number one, emotions. There's a big study that was done by a PhD, where he basically was going on to the battlefield and was talking to talking to soldiers. Julie Carpenter, a PhD in education at the University of Washington, she interviewed a bunch of explosive ordnance disposal personnel. Basically, if you've ever seen the Hurt Locker, those guys that go and take care of bombs. Like, you have all these crazy robots that they use that go out and basically get exploded in case something bad happens. She basically came to the conclusion that these guys are getting all friendly with these robots. They're being like, give them names. They're like, feel bad when they get blown up, like, and legitimately feel bad. Like, aw, little Johnny died. Like, oh, that's awesome. They're basically, it's funny. I mean, this goes back, so it's like the naming of cars, you know? Why do you call a Shelby Eleanor? I don't know. You got to give it a name, you know? There's a long history of people calling, you know, naming their guns, especially in the military with weapons, naming these things. And when your life
depends on... What's your iPhone's name?
Oh, you know what? I don't actually...
Okay, just checking.
But you know what? The Jeep that I drove in high school? Monica. Yeah, that's right.
Really?
Yeah, call her Monica. I technically, her dad owned it, so I don't know if dad... I never told dad that. But that's what I always called it.
Why?
Because. It's inappropriate talk for the... for the podcast. It's not really inappropriate. It's just not interesting.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. But anyway, so guys are naming it, and she's going, like, one of the big things that you find here is that it's common for people to have an emotional attachment to their tools, to their machines, but it's heightened with military guys, especially when you're, like, in high risk situations. And what her bigger concern here is that it's like these guys have emotional attachments to basically super sophisticated RC cars, right? But what happens as we get better and better robots that start doing more and more where on their own, you know, where you're not necessarily even giving them personality? It's not like Siri, where, you know, yelling at Siri is one of my favorite pastimes when she gets it wrong. the personality aspect of that is there. It's present. It's supposed to make you feel human. But these robots, even when they don't feel human, it's like she's like they are as inhuman as you can possibly get, and they're anthropomorphizing them. What happens is they become more human just for interactive purposes. They become more intelligent. Are we ever going to get to the point where soldiers are like, dude, don't send little Johnny in. He might get blown up. You're like, what do you... Okay. Which I think will be really fascinating as that kind of moves on. And I think what would be really funny if we get to the point where we have to... If you have to actually give the robots somewhat unique personalities so that little Johnny has a different person, you know, has a different personality from, Big Robert. So your little hunter drone has a different thing than this drone, so that when little Johnny goes up and blows up, you can take the next machine, the identical robot, and load little Johnny's personality back onto it. So everybody's like, all right. Little Johnny survived. He's back. Okay, thank goodness. Which is weird to think about because it's like, you know, to me, I get a new phone, Siri's still there. It's still the same Siri that I hate to, you know, that I love to hate, because she works so well so often. It's those one time, it's the few times that she doesn't work that it's just like, you infuriate me. But I sit there and I go, to me, Siri is the personality that kind of lives on top of the phone. And as these personal assistants become more intelligent, as the operating system develops its own personality, its own intuition, I think it'll decouple itself from the hardware. And you'll allow guys to bond with their machines emotionally, like we all do. And then all you have to do is download the keep your settings and download it into the next piece of hardware when it blows up. And in order to make sure that, you know, guys are all right with, you know, having their robots blow up because it's whatever. Which is fascinating that I think that psychologically we're already studying that and we're going to go in that direction, clearly, as far as I'm concerned. You know, maybe we'll get to the point where we don't have that, but we personalize our cell phones. I don't know why you wouldn't do that with your robots and on the same level. I don't know why we think it would be desirable for anybody that any computer, any robot that we interact with on a daily basis wouldn't have settings that allows us to personalize them for our own personal use. And why they'd all be, you know, like, I guess what I'm getting at is oftentimes Hollywood imagines, you know, the legion of identical robots, kind of like what you get in,
right,
in iRobot. But I just think that that's not realistic. I don't think it's going to be like that at all. I think they're all going to have personality settings that will tune to you over time or that you can adjust manually. Interesting. The other one that I wanted to bring up, and this is kind of exciting, is BMW's building factories with industrial equipment that work side by side with untrained people, aka robots that won't hurt people.
Nice.
It's been long-standing OSHA-type rules that in factories, robots and humans don't work side by side very closely. They get their own little quarantined part of the factory because they're heavy industrial machines, and they'll kill people real fast.
That's why you got to be really nice to them.
Exactly. The actual technical hurdle is that they're unaware of anything that's going on. They're only aware of what you tell them to be aware of. Mm-hmm. And basically what they're getting at is, like, nowadays robots or data acquisition, data sensing, what's going on around the world, we're getting way better at building robots that do two things. Number one, they know what's going on around them. They're contextually aware of their surroundings. You get too close to it, it knows and it slows down, it stops. And the other thing we're getting better at is really, really high finesse robots. The idea of robots where you grab it and it knows it and it'll follow you. And not it's weak, but it's that it's following you. So it feels like to the touch as you move it around, but that's just a really high, you know, tech sensors that are going in. And that's, you know, and that gets to the idea of like your Iron Man type suits. That's where that type of technology is being built, where it's, you know, it's fluid with the human being, but it's incredibly strong. It just knows where the person is. And so basically BMW's gotten to the point where they said, yeah, we built factories with these robots in there that are safe. You can work side by side on them. You can work close. Wow. And so essentially what they're saying is, you know, it still makes a lot of sense to have human beings in our work, in our factories doing particular tasks, but now you have the robot augmentation. So if you've got a really heavy piece that you need to pick up and flip over, or, you know, you got to get in all awkward in order to get that screw in, well, now we got a robot that just picks it up and flips it over for you. You walk up, you put it in there, it puts the car back down, whatever. You know, that's an extreme example. But that sort of a thing where the robot will do the parts that it's very difficult for humans to do, and then the humans will do the parts that are very difficult for robots to do, and they'll work in tandem. And now they
Which
can do that
with... Be what? Would be hard for a robot to do. I feel like they're good at everything.
You want to know what the truth is? It's extremely expensive to build specific robots for every task. It's a gigantic capital investment. And they've already got a bunch of unionized employees.
So they're bad at being cheap. Got it.
Yes. And they've already got a bunch of unionized employees. And so what BMW's basically set up here is, and this is so funny because they put it right in the article, they go, this is really good for employees. This isn't bad for employees at all, because what it does is it lengthens the amount of time that you can work, because some of these physical tasks are too difficult. And so we basically had to hire younger people, which pushed out the older people. And in order to do the heavy, difficult tasks. And so they're like, now the robots do the heavy, difficult tasks, which will extend the amount of the technical stuff that's good for humans to do, where they can do it cheaper, more, you know, more effectively, more efficiently. Where they can do that, the robots will, you know, they'll work together just like a young and an old dude used to work together. And basically what BMW is saying is it's going to take us like 20 years to kind of cover all the capital expense of this. And so as people retire, we're just going to replace them with robots. And then by the time you realize that the union's been completely broken because you've been replaced by robots, it'll be too late. And, you know, which is just kind of amazing that that's the way that that's going to go, because that's been a big question for GM and Ford and Chrysler. Like, how do, you know, it's the obvious direction is to go with robots. How do we break the unions so that they'll let us? Because it's negotiated with the unions that they can only implement so many automated processes at a time, guaranteeing a continued workforce. Yeah. And it's a constant give and take. And so basically, you know, this is another company that's saying, yeah, we'll keep the workforce around. Don't worry until you retire. You got a job until you retire, and then your kid won't have a job. You know, great, awesome. Which I think is great and awesome in a very long term sort of way.
Long term, yes.
Short term, it's a pretty good gambit. Midterm, it's gonna be pretty uncomfortable. So I don't know. It's interesting.
From a technology standpoint, we love it.
Super exciting. I love it. Yeah. You know, this is where I kind of get into I hate to come off as a socialist, but I think it might be necessary at some point. Eventually, why can't robots do everything? I read a really interesting article about why isn't it our goal to have everybody work 20-hour work weeks?
Yeah, you know? Dude. What's that? Jetsons, then they only work like 4 hours a week or something ridiculous like that.
Yeah, and that's the
big
question.
And all you had to do is press a button too.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like you really ask the question
because
why.
Because we are competitive human beings.
Well, I know, but I mean, it's, you know, if Google's goal is to get us to live to 120, why can't somebody else's goal be to get us to, you know, where you only have to work 20 hours?
Recreate a majority of those years?
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Because you got to have more. You got to want more. And in order to get more, you got to earn more.
Well, we always wanted to get more because we didn't have enough to survive. We now have enough to survive. We're clearly into the thriving point. We're to the point where we entertain ourselves.
How come you don't? You could work less, right?
Maybe, yeah.
I mean, you gotta.
Well, okay, no. This is more important. This is more important. I could work more, and I don't. You know, you know.
Are you working less than 40?
No. But I could be doing something right now that, you know, that I could be working at a fast food restaurant that gives me a guaranteed income right now, as opposed to doing this. This is more fulfilling than the paycheck would be. But that's my point. It's like, you know, but this is work. I mean, this takes a lot of energy and a lot of time, and I just don't make any money doing it, but it's fulfilling. And it's my 40-hour a week job that allows me to do that, to afford everything else that I have and do this. And I think that that's a continuing trend that you'll see. I don't see any reason to think that that wouldn't become bigger and bigger and bigger. And if I, you know, I don't know. I
the trend that I typically see, you know, is you look at someone like yourself, right? Today, you're totally satisfied living in, you know, or sharing a house with somebody, you know, in your current situation. And there will come a time when that won't be good enough and you will want more, and that will require you to work more, you know, trying to earn more or whatever. You made the comment that, you know, where people, their minimum, you know, basic living requirements have been met, so therefore we should work less and let robots do their thing. I'm like, I just haven't.
I think there's a weird thing that's going to happen. I don't know how it's going to balance all out, but I like the idea of saying, you know, what happens if we could get the means of production so efficient and so effective to the point where, it would be very difficult to simply produce more, because everything, it'd be difficult for humans to.
One of the nice things that we learned in economics is, we have unlimited wants. So, We'll never have a shortage of things to make, trust me.
Well, you say you want have unlimited wants, but I have a feeling that human psychology says there's a limit to that. It's virtually unlimited until you can actually have unlimited means, and then we'll really test the...
Right, which I would say we're nowhere near it, and so it's not a big deal.
It can be there someday. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. Yeah. Anyways.
All right. So... That was a weird conversation.
Yeah, I want to talk about...
why? Sorry. It's my turn. It's my
okay,
turn.
You're right. Sorry. I'm sorry.
My turn. Because I have to. I am contractually obliged to talk about HP. And as a friendly reminder, I do not represent HP or any of their opinions about new products they launch or anything. And that's important because HP... launched a slew of products this last week. They were attempting to compete with that fruit company.
Printers? Oh, okay, no.
Yep. So, let's see here. We will start with some tablets. So, HP released six new tablets this week.
A 16, a 32, and a 64 gig hard drives with Wi-Fi and LTEs, two options? Because Apple launches six occasion.
No. No, exactly. No. The first one is a Slate 8 Pro. Care to guess how big it is?
8 inches.
8 inches. It's about the same size as an iPad mini, approximately. It's got stats related to it. It's like I said, it's iPad mini. It's got the cameras. It's a 1600x1200.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just thought it was a funny way to put it. I don't want to know the stats.
Exactly. So it's got them. The next other one is the Slate 7 HD and the Slate 10 HD. To guess what makes them special?
They've got 1080p screens and they've got 7 and 10 inches diagonal.
Diagonally. They also got Beats audio and optional 4G connectivity. So depending on how you look at that, that's another two. and they're keeping the original Slate 7. So it's a 7-inch screen in HD. They're keeping the old Slate 7, which is non-HD. And now they're adding a 10 HD, and then they've got that 8 Pro. They're also adding a Slate 7 Extreme. Okay, so 7 inches. Extreme. But what makes it different from the 7 or the from the regular or the HD...
The Extreme. That's what makes it different.
Is it has the Tegra 4 processor. So it's given it some gaming credentials.
Nice.
But it doesn't have an HD screen. So, you know, you're kind of like, oh, that's okay. So they are like...
What operating system is that running?
Android.
Okay.
All four of those are Android. But don't worry, HP's got more coming. There's also the Pavilion 11X2, which is a Windows tablet.
Cool. So they're not going to sell any of those, is the plan?
It's, we'll see. I can't remember if it's the 11 or the next one. I've seen them. They're actually genuinely cool.
I believe it.
Tablets. You know, they run Windows 8, so you're like, well, you know. Thanks. But
I also thought the Surface Pro was pretty cool. And yeah. They didn't sell any of those either.
Yeah, so this one uses Intel's Bay Trail series. It can get up to 4 gigs of RAM, 128 gigs of flash storage, which is nice. Essentially, it's the upgrade from last year's thing.
4 gigs of RAM is all?
It's... Oh, it'll have a dock and stuff, so you can get your keyboard and plug it into a bigger screen, things like that. Did they mention the prices for these other ones? I'm not seeing prices. But that Windows one is going to be for 600 bones, including the dock. So, you know, because it's kind of the expectation is you're going to dock this thing, and it's kind of a, think of it as a hybrid. And the other one is the Omni 10. Again, it's using the Bay Trail chipset. It's got a nicer screen. They're going to ship it in November. It's going to run Windows 8.1. It's looks like it's not as good as the Pavilion 11 X2. So that was a lot. They announced one other product, which we'll get to. But yeah, so the I learned about this this summer, I guess.
And you've been holding it back.
It's been really hard. Essentially, HP, it was actually really cool in this meeting. I can share this. They're all public now. They shared this chart where they had done a good job of splicing up the market into different tablet use cases or customers and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then plotted out where all the current tablets were. And essentially we're able to say we've noticed some gaps in the market, places where we can genuinely add value and, you know, make an offering that's different than what's already out there. So you'll notice, like, with these, even the 10-inch HD one, it's not really made to compete against the iPad. The comparisons will be made because that's the way it is. But they're genuinely for different use cases, and they'll be marketed that way. But it was kind of cool to see this, like, you know, they had all the different tablets on the market and the way that they were all, positioned and stuff like that. And so these are all made to fit in kind of what those gaps were in different places. And they were like, yeah, we're going to do this rapidly. And they weren't kidding. I knew it was, I wasn't sure if it was going to be four or six different tablets. And then they're even keeping the existing ones, so they're up to seven now, different types. But that's the way the HP rolls, right? They like to do a lot of different – they believe that there are a lot of different types of customers, and they want a product for each and every single one of them.
It's not a bad strategy at all.
Samsung, it's working for them. And to be fair, there isn't any good Android tablet –
It's funny. I mean, it's, you know, I think getting into the smartphone market right now would be pretty, not necessarily a fool's errand, but you'd better have some serious firepower if you're going to do that. But the Android tablet market and the Microsoft tablet market, I still think there's, I agree. I think there's an opening. There really is. And it's like, And not necessarily competing against Apple, or specifically not competing against Apple. The market's still growing. People are still deciding that they want those over there. As your PC dies, as your laptop dies, people are looking to replace it. And if you can give them something that will allow them to, you know, justify keeping their PC for an extra 2 years because they got a tablet instead and it was cheaper and it's cool and they get to bring it with them, and especially in developing countries where, you know, the iPads are still way too expensive, there's definitely space there. I want one with the new Ubuntu OS. That would be pretty cool. I really want that. I don't know why. It gets me all excited. the nerd in me. But I think that, you know, I think there's a space there, and if they can get the right price points, and get the right message and get the right salespeople, I don't think there's any reason why they can't have, at least mild success. But the reality of it is, it's not like Samsung's doing any business there. They launch tablets and kill them before the next ones come out because they do so terribly. Microsoft is, you know, they're firing their CEO over their disaster. You know, Apple sells them like crazy. There's clearly a desire for it, and I don't think it's just because it's got a an Apple with a bite taken out of it logo on the back. I think there's a legitimate desire and use case there. It's just that nobody's executing on a salesmanship level like Apple is with the iPad. I think it's, you know, for whatever reason, Samsung figured out how to sell their phones. They can't figure out how to sell a tablet using the same message, basically. And I think if HP just comes in and they work with, you know, they work with Fry's, they work with Best Buy's, they work with Walmart, they work with everybody and say, hey, figure out what the people needs, and if they want this, give them this. If they want that, give them this. If they want that, give them this. And then all of a sudden you sit there and you go, people walk in and go, you know, what I really want to do is X, Y, and Z on my tablet. And I was thinking about getting an iPad, and then the salesperson sells them on an HP. You know, that's how they're going to win, I really think, is where it's going to come down to. And we'll see if they do that. But I think there's potential more than there are in phones, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. They've got an opportunity to take it, and I think I haven't played with any of them. All I've seen are the spec sheets and photos, so I don't fully know. I do know the Elite Pad's pretty cool, running Windows 7 on it, and I've played with the original Slate, and it's a cool device. I don't think I'm actually going to get my Slate 7. I feel like I should have gotten it already if I was going to. I might have found out that I wasn't eligible. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I still want one. So.
Oh, yeah.
There's that. The other thing that HP released is a new laptop, which is the first to have Leap Motion integrated inside of it.
Oh, baby. That's exciting. So
it's real. And HP's got will be the only ones to carry it for a while. And then eventually you'll see it coming into other stuff. But they figured out how to make the sensor a little bit smaller, a little bit thinner. Oddly enough, they moved it off over to the right of the touchpad to make room for it. And so, like, when you're controlling it, you got to move over a little bit and then do your control deal, which is a little strange. I was reading this Verge article on it, and they were like, well, we didn't like Leap Motion to begin with, so take everything we just say with a grain of salt. It's like, great. You know, but it's a big coup for Leap Motion. They're going to be shipping in a bunch of different laptops, I'm guessing. And especially with Windows 8, the way it's made to be touched and moved and stuff, I bet it'll be really good for navigation. Like, we've talked about Leap Motion before, but HP released the first laptop with that, just built in out of the box. No accessory, no wires. It's just there.
It's cool, man. I think that'll be big news for Leap, and because it, you know, gets people moving in the right direction with that. You know, this only costs $80.
Man.
I kind of want one.
Cheaper than a DS.
I have been really, 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 really wanting to spend my money today. I nearly bought a PlayStation 3 Grand Theft Auto 5 bundle today.
Why didn't you, man? That would have been awesome. PlayStation 3? You shouldn't have done that.
I'd say two reasons. Two reasons. Number one, because it was the PlayStation 3 and the 4 is a month away. That's why it's at a huge discount. But but I was like, I'm just not that type of person. Like, cars, oh, I'll do that all day long. You know, betting, yeah, give me the cheapest thing I can find. Like, I'm super conservative. Technology, I'm like, if it's not cutting edge, why would I even want it? Go away. You know, that was one of the big ones. The other one is I own Grand Theft Auto 4, and I've owned it for like 4 months, and I still haven't even downloaded it onto my computer. I got it through Steam during the Steam summer sale. And I was like, if I haven't played Grand Theft Auto 4, why in the world do I think I'd spend any time playing Grand Theft Auto 5? I know the answer to that question. It's because all of my friends are playing it, and it would make me, you know, I want to be one of the cool kids. That's a cool game. Yeah. But it's just really hard to justify that, and so I decided not to. But I've almost bought it like 3 times in the last week.
So you were not part of the record-breaking sales for...
I was not.
GTA 5, huh?
A bill. Yeah. They're crushing movies. Movies don't even come close. It's crazy. I mean, development costs are crazy high on video games. So percentage-wise, it'd be interesting to see if, you know... I think you'll have a major title change once, percentage-wise, how much it costs to make the game versus how much they're making makes that switch where the ratio of cost to profit is bigger on video games, not just overall profits, which overall profits are are crushing the movies. I mean, like, you only the biggest blockbusters in all of Hollywood compete with your, like, average blockbuster video game nowadays. It's crazy. It's just absolutely insane.
Are you allowed to say that with your average blockbuster video game? Is that allowed?
That's a good point. I think so. But it's just, you know, it's like Hollywood's going to produce 2-3 blockbusters a year that are going to do $1 billion worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, over the entire course of their run. And the movie industry or the video game industry launches, you know, 10 titles a year that do that in the first 2 weeks, you know, and much less the total lifetime of the game. It's crazy how much money they're making on these things, man. It's just, it's out of this world. You know, this is like, you know, this year, BioShock, Grand Theft Auto 4, not to mention the onslaught of games that are going to come out when the PS4 and the Xbox go on sale. It's just, it's crazy what's going on in the video game industry right now. It's absolutely insane.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's good for us, but
I got to watch Grand Theft Auto being played Friday night. He was flying around an airplane. I was like, wait, what? You can fly? Man, I'm in.
I know.
But it looks pretty awesome.
I know. It looks, oh my goodness. They're doing such a good job. Rockstar is knocking it out of the park, but it's cool.
So I think we got enough time for one more, and you should probably tell your story.
Okay. So I used to call him a friend. I don't know if I can call him a friend anymore.
Does he know that he has personally attacked you?
Not yet. Okay. I'm probably going to try to talk to him this week. Let him know. His name is Jacob Cooper. He is an Apple engineer, and he made my life really annoying this week.
Just a personal attack on you.
Personal attack. He loaded this bug into iOS specifically to hurt me, I'm pretty sure. So basically what happened was, with iOS 7, they launched all these new technologies that nobody had any idea what was going on, and things are slowly kind of slipping out about what's actually in it, what does it do, you know, and everything in there. And one of the cool little pieces of technology that was slipped in there was multi-path TCP. And basically, the long and short of what that is that within your server context, sometimes in the internet, you've got these packets, right? And they go from come from one location, they go to a destination and back and forth. And the route that they take is different every time. They go all over the place. It's part of the whole internet thing, is this idea of load bearing and being able to distribute all these packets all over the place.
Yep.
Pretty cool. But they really need one location and one destination. Well, it turned out that if you had like multiple ports on the same server system, like let's say you have a Linux server rack with a bunch of different communication stuff, I don't know, your Google or your Apple or your whatever, it made sense to create what they called a multipath TCP, which was essentially saying that the destination origin, we're going to create a protocol that allows us to basically say we're going to have a virtual one place, but it could be any one of these. And the client, the other side, not the server, will think it's only one place. It'll have one number, but the other side of it will be able to handle that and know where everything's going. And when it does that, what it essentially allows you to do is have all these different ports. Very cool. Well, nobody's actually like implemented that in a widespread way on a small scale, because there never was really a point. You had Wi-Fi in your computer, you had one location, or you had LTE on your phone, you had one location where you're like, all data is going to route in and out of this, so why would we have a really sophisticated TCP thing going on? Well, obviously, if you're paying attention at all, your phone has Wi-Fi and LTE. It's got two. So all of a sudden, it made sense for them to integrate some sort of a TCP technology where you're like, it doesn't really matter which one's going on. The server and the client can be going between any one of their ports, any one of their antennas, doing whatever they want, but they're keeping track of where it's supposed to go on their end, and then the internet keeps track of all the packets in between, so it's okay, it can go all over the place. It's really exciting because basically what it means is that there is zero interruption now between switching from Wi-Fi to LTE and back and forth. You hit that button, as soon as it kicks off Wi-Fi, you're already on LTE. Nice. If you ever like streaming a video and turn off Wi-Fi for some reason, or doing anything, there were huge interruptions as the iPhone switched the process, stopped what it was doing, and didn't. Yeah, so this is cool. This is really cool. Happens that Jacob Cooper, my buddy, the kid who I went to high school with and kid on the football field and did all sorts of fun, he was the dude that was like doing this, implementing this technology in iOS 7. I was super stoked to talk about it on the show because I was like, oh my gosh, I know it. I understand what this is. I can explain it, which is cool and, you know, always fun. And it's like my buddy, Jacob Cooper, Coop Dog, Cooper, you know, like I was so excited about it. And then Thursday, he punched me in the face, metaphorically, because...
Technologically,
yes. Virtually punched me in the face. I was running dangerously close to my data cap. And I knew this. My 3 gigs of data. AT&T, I hate you. But, you know, whatever, it happens. Okay, it's going to cost me a little bit extra this month. And then all of a sudden Thursday, I popped over the 3 gigs. I still got a couple of days left in my billing cycle. It's going to cost me 10 extra bucks. I'm not happy about it, but whatever. It was my fault. I was watching too much Vine early in the month. I know. I stopped. Okay, chill out, everybody. Well, I decided to test out this new – I decided to was trying out the new Apple TV features. And I ended up started to download a movie over Wi-Fi, which is pretty cool, at work. And I'm just like downloading whatever. Decided to go for a walk on my 15-minute break because that's what I do. I get up, I walk out. And by the time I get back, I get this text message from AT&T saying, you've gone over your billing cycle. And if you're really paying attention at this point in the show, you can probably guess what happened. Yeah, that's right. It automatically switched from Wi-Fi to LTE. And I hadn't turned off the little switch on that would prevent it from downloading over LTE. And because iOS 7 doesn't know the difference anymore, it doesn't know there's no interruption, it doesn't happen automatically, it downloaded half of the movie, an entire gig of the movie, over my LTE antenna.
And you're welcome.
An extra 10 bucks. I am... so angry. I can't stand it. I can't even, I can't even believe it. It's just like, I think I'm going to make him, I'm going to go and make him like, give me money. That's actually, you know, it's funny. He used to like, back when I was fat in high school, I used to borrow money from him all the time to buy cookies at lunch and like never, ever paid him back. So I'm probably in debt to him. Like, I don't know. Couple hundred bucks from high school. I don't think you remember that at all, but it would make me feel pretty
bad. There's no reason to bring it up.
Exactly. I want my 10 bucks, Jacob Cooper, you jerk face. This is your fault. I'm sorry. I couldn't believe it. I was so angry. It's just frustrating, man. Oh,
AT&T is very happy with this outcome.
I know. And it's interesting because it's like, it's funny. I read an article. They're like, you know, you got to be careful about how you implement this because now there's no natural barrier. Like if there's a simple bug where you don't automatically have something turn off, you could all of a sudden burn through all your data. And I was like, yeah, that's a good point. I'll bet they thought that through.
Yep.
Nope, they didn't. Evidently.
Wow.
Or they did, and
they
just
did.
You know what? I think Cooper was just like, I got this one. I know what's gonna happen. So jerk, man.
So there you go.
What a punk.
So there you go. Well, on that note, we're gonna call it.
Okay.
We'll cut the data off at this point and take it easy. So, So, everybody, thank you for joining us. My name is James Furlow. My award-winning brother is Matthew Furlow.
Yeah.
And we will talk next time. Thank you.